Okay, thank you very much for helping me to set up the talk. Thank you very much for the organizers for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to talk about this subject. I would like to talk mainly about the fermionic Casimir effect in connection with a scattering approach, and only occasionally go over to the scalar Casimir effect. This work was done in collaboration with Aurel Bulgak from Seattle and Piotr Magierski from Warsaw, where, as I am, a nuclear physicist. I will start off with some general remarks about the Casimir effect and its geometry dependence, but then generalize to bubbles in the Fermi sea. Sometimes the Casimir effect is colloquially addressed as the force from nothing onto something. Now have the force from something onto nothing. So then I will map this problem to a multi-scattering problem of a point particle. That's the essential point for scattering approach. Discuss the interactions of 2, 3, and 4 bubbles in the Fermi sphere. Mention the generalization to superfluid bubbles. And if I have time, I will talk a little bit about the scalar Casimir effect, otherwise I will conclude. So, okay, I have to do only this one. Yeah, I mean, this is all known. I mean, probably don't have to repeat it. I mean, in 1948, Casimir postulated this force, but only depended on fundamental constants. The reason that one way to explain it, as we know now, I mean, one way to explain it, this Casimir effect is that the zero-point fluctuations of the electromagnetic field get modified by the presence of the plates relative to the free case, or rather relative to the case that the plates are infinitely separate. So this is also what you do in experiment. You have prepared your plates, you move them together. The Casimir effect that I will discuss today resembles more with Navier Casimir effect. You have the shielding of waves by objects. In this case, you have a shielding of waves in between that, the secondary waves that where two ships in a no-wind situation rolling in the sea, basically parallel, and they produce secondary waves of all wave types, wavelengths. And the secondary waves in between are shielded or suppressed in comparison to the secondary waves outside. And so the ships apparently move together and entangle, and in the end, the masts do entangle, as the French Navy observed in the beginning of the 19th century and had a prescription to row away these ships if they come too close to each other in the situation of no wind and rolling sea. Well, the distinctive feature of a Casimir effect that I would like to play with is the geometry dependence, and we know that this geometry dependence is in a non-intuitive way. Since it was addressed yesterday, let me mention at least one relation between the Casimir effect and vacuum energy of QFT, quantum field theory. We know that there are zero-point energies around. Also in QFT, if you do your first course in QFT or teach your first course in QFT, you encounter the zero-point energies pretty soon. But the way to treat them is just to discard them, subtract them, or we define them away by normal ordering, etc. So you can redefine your energy origin for one system, but you can do it for one system only once. And when you have to live with that, and if you introduce now plates in the system, then the difference in between the zero-point energies becomes physical. So the Casimir effect, you could also say, is that in the quantum field theory type of thinking, is the difference of properly regularized eigenmode sums of constrained quantum field theory minus the corresponding eigenmode sums of a free quantum field theory. So here's the expression in the formula. So you have, your modes in a quantization volume that you eventually let go to infinity. You have a regularization term that you also eventually let go to infinity. You have a statistical factor depending on whether you talk about relativistic bosons or relativistic fermions. And then you have these difference of these mode sums. And the constraints can be, of course, come from gravity. I have no idea what one should do in this situation. They can come from external fields. Anomalies are done in terms of mode sums. It's not a Casimir energy. It's a Casimir number that is affected by this. These constraints can come from internal fields. For instance, you can calculate the QCD vacuum. As a Casimir calculation, the difference between the perturbative QCD vacuum and the non-perturbative QCD vacuum. Keywords are Savity vacuum or Copenhagen vacuum. Or from geometry-dependent boundary conditions, two plates, two half spheres, etc. So let me remind you about the original Casimir effect. This was very simple because the original Casimir effect is a separable problem because of the geometry is separable. And therefore, you can decouple the electromagnetic problem in two scalar field problems, one with Dirichlet boundary conditions on the plates and one with Neumann boundary conditions on the plates. So you have two mode sums. One starts at n equals 0, one starts at n equals 1. Otherwise, they are the same. You, for instance, introduce an exponential cutoff. You have seen that already in this workshop. When you integrate over the wave numbers in the direction of a plane, and you multiply by the area, or divide through the area if you want to have a Casimir energy per unit area. And that's where you are. Then the rest is just simple algebra. You find a term that diverges as with a cutoff to a fourth power. This is basically a volume term. Then you encounter a term that diverges with a cutoff to a third power. Then you get the finite Casimir expression, and then terms that vanish if you would let the cutoff go to infinity. Now, what's about these diversion terms? The background term drops out if you subtract the free reference system. And for the electromagnetic case, you are lucky. The surface terms that you have here cancel out just. The Neumann and Dirichlet case cancel out. But you could, of course, imagine you would have a pure Dirichlet situation, a scalar Dirichlet, fluctuating Dirichlet field between the two plates. This term is also not dangerous because it would be connected to the plates, and it's completely unaffected by the separation. This factor L cancels against that factor L. The separation drops out. So you have once paid the price by preparing the plates, but if you have prepared the plates, this term doesn't change anything any longer. You can, of course, understand this UV cutoff as connected to the plasma frequency. And you see when if you move two infinitely far separated plates to a finite distance L, all these dangerous terms cancel out, and the leading term is basically the finite Casimir expression, and you can let then the cutoff go to infinity. So that was all what I wanted to say about the Casimir effect as such. Let me come now to generalizations of the concept of Casimir energy. Let me start out with a geometry dependence. Let's just invert things. You worry about the geometry dependence in connection with Casimir effect, just invert it and say, this is what the Casimir energy is. It's the geometry dependent part of a vacuum energy. Define it just like this. And so you can then make use of machinery from other fields, semi-classics, nuclear physics, whatever, shell models, atomic physics. So you have a density of state that you can classify as is given here, the definition of a density of state, and you can classify it by contributions from the free case, that is basically the case of a fluctuating photons or fermions or scalar fields, fluctuating scalar fields. Then you have the bulk terms. Basically, if you introduce obstacles in the system, it costs you a price, and that is in these bulk terms. And then you have really the density of state that depends on the geometry. So only this part is the interesting part, and only that part gives you the Casimir energy. So you take this geometry-dependent part of a density of states that you get from somewhere, fold it with the energy, and integrate up the energy, and you have the Casimir energy. And you can do a partial integration and relate it to the geometry-dependent part of the number density of states if you want to. In order to do this partial integration, you have to introduce a regularizing factor and then remove a regularizing factor at the end. So this was one way to generalize the concept of cosmic energy. Another step is to introduce metafields, and that I want to discuss now. Here we assume that the space is not filled with fluctuating electromagnetic modes or fluctuating scalar modes, but with a gas of non-interacting and non-relativistic fermions to make our life simple. There's a similarity. In both cases, you have mode sums with constant degeneracy factor. In the electromagnetic case, because you have all the time, for each mode, two polarization states of the photons. And for the fermion case, because of Pauli's exclusion principle. So, for metafields, Pauli exclusion principle makes sure that you have a constant degeneracy factor. Of course, the degeneracy can be different from two. You can have spin, you can have isospin, etc. There's a difference between these two mode sums. Namely, in the fermionic case, you would only sum up modes up to the Fermi momentum or Fermi energy, or the chemical potential at T equals zero. So you get another scale in addition to the geometrical scales, and that also induces that the physics in the fermionic case is dominated at that scale, the UV scale, basically Fermi energy, versus the standard Casimir effect is dominated by the longest distances in the problem. So to be concrete, we assume metafields fermions in the space between voids. So you have bubbles in the Fermi sea. And these voids obstruct the free movement of the fermions. And therefore, the quantum pressure that the fermions exert on the voids depend on the geometry, or relative geometry of the voids. So altogether, we expect an effective Casimir type interaction between empty regions of space in the background of non-interacting fermions. So the fermions are non-interacting. You have empty regions of space, nothing. Still, you would expect a force just through the shielding of a fermions. So an application or application where this may be important is in the inner crust of a neutron star. If you go inside a neutron star, with increasing pressure and density, you observe that the nuclei will lose their neutrons below saturation density. Saturation density is at 0.16 Fermi minus cubed. So in this area range, you have nuclei and gas of neutrons. So on the standard folklore is the volume energy is for both systems the same. So which configuration will win depends on an interplay between the Coulomb forces and the surface energy. And people have established then a change of an Italian vacua, namely meatballs, spaghetti, and pasta vacua, depending on the situation. You start out with nuclei surrounded by low-density neutron matter. Then if you increase the density, the nuclei will fuse to form rods, and the low-density neutron matter is outside. Then these rods will fuse to form slabs. Then, if you increase the density, the low-density phase is in the form of slabs, and the high-density phase is outside. The slabs will split into rows or pasta or spaghetti, and the spaghetti is split into holes, and the surrounding high density phases looks like a Swiss cheese here at this stage. And eventually you hit the region where you have uniform nuclear matter. This pattern could of course repeat here also in this area where you have, instead of neutral matter, you have hadronic matter, and you might have quark gluon plasma matter. So, but what we have forgotten in this thinking is that we have a holes or bubbles in the Fermi sea. And Bulgak and Magyarsky, my co-authors, have found out that the order of magnitude of these neglected terms is in the same order of the difference between, Coulomb and surface energies. So you have a competition. And this structure was completely forgotten in the calculations for the Italian vacua. So this situation might, as mentioned, might repeat itself if you have here uniform nuclear matter, and then you start building in quark, gluon, plasma matter. So you might again start with a kind of spaghetti, meatball vacua, spaghetti vacua, pasta vacua, inside-out pasta vacua, inside-out spaghetti, and Swiss cheese. You might even dream of doing this in the lab by, for instance, taking buckyballs, C60 molecules, immersed in an electron gas. Where do you get the electron gas from? Maybe liquid mercury can do the job. I mean, it's not important that the mercury is liquid allows the movement of buckyballs. What you use is, of course, the electron gas of conductance electrons. The buckyballs live in that gas.
The other place where one might go exotic phases like that in fermionic systems is in semiconductors, as well, uh-huh. where you have very exotic behavior in some semiconductor systems at low temperature, under magnetic fields, mm-hmm. and so on. Is there any
nuclear crystals, that sort of thing? Yeah. Excitonic insulators, various different things.
Good.
That's
I'm not aware of this, but the problem with this, how do you measure when the force? I mean, it's everything is rigid, right? And you need some kind of liquid. So.
But I think it's the electrons.
You need, of course, to measure the force on the voids. The force. Eventually you have to observe the movement of the force or of the voids.
So you're saying it's not just a question of stability of the various
phases. Okay, good. That could be where. I'm not aware of it, but you might have a point here. So you could, of course, also replace the mercury by the liquid free helium. You could dream of Bose-Einstein droplets in a dilute atomic fermion condensate as another system where you form voids in a Fermi sea in a lab. So the calculation, if you would have two plates in this Fermi sea, then the calculation is pretty simple. You basically repeat the original calculation. You only have now a sharp cutoff. And the energy would scale with the chemical potential, and then you would have an oscillating behavior with a sine or cosine. So that's usual, that's not very difficult. For more complicated geometries, as usual, the calculations get demanding. However, in the case of non-overlapping spherical voids, the calculation can be still simple. The reason is you can make use of the scattering approach, where you have a relationship between the level density and the phase shift. In general, the phase shift in a problem is given by the log determinant of the S matrix. So the problem doesn't need to be separable. So you have a non-separable problem. You calculate for this non-separable problem the S matrix. You take the determinant and the log, and that's then the phase shift. And this should be connected to the level density by the Krein formula that gives the difference between the full density of states and the background density of states where you only have a gas, the fluctuating gas of photons or the matter gas of fermions. And this difference averaged, here you have to make a small averaging procedure, I will come back to this, is related to the derivative with respect to energy of a log determinant or trace log of a full S matrix of a problem. If you have non-overlapping voids, it's the n-sphere S matrix. So, and this is not all. You are not after this quantity. You are after the quantity that is geometry-dependent. So you have to subtract once more the bike term from this problem. But you extract the geometry-dependent Casimir fluctuations from not the full S-matrix, but the multi-scattering part of the S-matrix. So we have to scatter at both obstacles, for instance. So, and in this way, you have now mapped the calculation to a quantum mechanical billiard problem of a point particle scattering hyperbolically of N-spheres or N-disks, so with these famous quantum repellers, I mean, the quantum pinball ball machine here, or the, I mean, this famous three-disk problem in chaotic problems. Yeah, I mean, if you have just one obstacle, of course, the problem is separable, but you don't have a Casimir effect, as mentioned. I mean, you have no geometry dependence. If you have two obstacles, you can have a geometry dependence, two spheres or two disks, and the problem is hyperbolic. I mean, if you, if you have a wave tube hitting one of the spherical obstacles, it will be broadened, reflected. So it's hyperbolic. If you have three or more obstacles, in general, the problem will be even chaotic. As you can see here in this three-disk problem, you start with two trajectories close by. And after a couple of reflections, four or five reflections, even the topology of these trajectories is completely different.
I can just ask simplistically, think boats. Hmm? It's still thinking boats. It's purely that.
Good. I come back to this. Good. So you have mapped. You can map this problem via this formula. Here you have your density. You have mode sums on this on the left hand side. On the right hand side, you have a point particle scattering of a point particle from this the same obstacles. So and. I will not explain for you the total Krein formula. I will explain for you a precessor of a Krein formula from 1937. I think this was the first. Maybe I'm mistaken, but I think this was the first formula in this sense. You have other names for a Krein formula. Sometimes you hear it named Friedel formula or Friedel formula. Sometimes people in the QCD lattice community. We call it Lüscher formula and things like this. I mean, it's so it has several names.
I'm getting push and pull confused. I'm sorry. I'm probably the only person in the room not understanding this. You want us to think about the guys that bump around and then come out?
No, the obstacles are fixed. It's point particles that bump around. I will explain. If you wait two transparencies,
my two difficult words are push and pull.
Okay. Good. I will explain one more and two transparencies, and then if you have not, then we should go slowly through it. So let's first explain for you the Bethe and Uhlenbeck formula, or the Krein formula for this simple system. We have a spherical potential, and we put it into a spherical box at the origin. So the system is separable. And the box is large, and you increase this radius r, and you subtract an empty reference box, where you have, of course, here you have your modes in between and things like this. That's the same. So asymptotic on this reference box, you can put any boundary what you would like. Let's put Dirichlet boundary conditions to make our life simple. We will see it doesn't matter in the end. So you have asymptotically, you have then these radial wave functions. The only difference between the case with the spherical potential and without the spherical potential is the presence of a phase shift, in addition to the angular momentum part and the wave number part. Now, so because of these boundary conditions, you have eigenvalue conditions that are here in three dimensions, 2L plus 1 fold degenerate with the angular momentum. So you have here the eigenvalue conditions, the wave number, the angular momentum piece, the phase shift, and the principal quantum number, here the same. Now let's imagine that we change the principal quantum number by one unit, keep the angular momentum fixed. So in order to balance this eigenvalue conditions, you have to increase the wave number by a bit for the full system, also for the reference system. If you increase n by one unit, you have 2L plus 1 new quanta in the system, and you can match this condition to the density of states times delta KL. Here you have to do averaging, otherwise the whole thing doesn't make sense. I mean, if you have a level density where there's a sum over delta distributions, it would not make sense. You have to make an averaging here. That's for sure. So now you have two equations, this equation, that equation. You solve for the average full level density, subtract the average reference level density. You can express everything by this equation as 1 over delta KL for both systems. Delta KL 0 full and delta KL reference. And by, if you subtract now these two quantities from each other, the information about the quantization box radius is gone. It's completely dropped out of this equation. You have a relationship between the full density of states averaged minus the reference and density of states. 2L plus 1, this is this factor here, divided by 1 over pi, that comes from here, if I take it in the denominator, and the derivative respect to the phase shift. So this is basically Bethe-Uhlenbeck. Very simple, using that expression. So, and then the Krein formula is only generalization of this result to non-separable problems. So you have at this stage not the derivative of a phase shift, but the derivative of a log determinant of the S matrix. So since this question came up also last week, I want to discuss the relationship. I will discuss this system once more. If you have a determinant of a scattering matrix, semi-classically, this is basically spectral information. And semi-classically, it can only depend on periodic or closed orbits. It cannot depend on trajectories from the outside, because these trajectories coming from the outside would depend on the coordinate system. Since it's spectral information, it cannot depend on the coordinate system. So it can only depend on closed periodic orbits that give you information about the spectral property. Now, so this is this part. Semi-classically, you have a matching of these two. This formula, and semi-classically, it corresponds to the sum of all possible periodic orbits weighted in a certain suitable way. Now, if you introduce your container and subtract the empty reference system, you are back to the Krein formula. Here's the Krein formula, the full system, the empty reference system. However, by doing that, you have smuggled into the system new periodic orbits that used to be not there before, namely the orbits that hit come from the container. These drop, these blue orbits still drop because the empty reference container is subtracting them. However, you have also spurious orbits. These are there because you might go periodically between the outside surface and the scattering system, back and forth, or here, back and forth, or here, forth, or more complicated movements. And these do not drop out by the subtraction of empty reference container. However, these periodic orbits increase in length if I increase the container radius. So one way is one has to punish their contribution, and one way to punish their contribution, since they increase in length with the outside radius, is to add a damping term or an imaginary term in the wave number such that they eventually drop out. And you have to do it in a suitable order, namely first let the container go to infinity, only then you can remove this averaging or damping factor. If you work with finite systems, as if you want to come to, invert this formula, you want to use two bounded reference systems to infer about the scattering matrix or the Green's function, then you have to work with finite damping terms. Basically, you have to damp about the mean level spacing. That things make sense. So, you can really calculate the scattering determinant approximately from such a system with a finite container subtracting empty reference container as long as you smuggle in a finite damping term. So, and the last part, let me be brief on this one. Now, if you have if you think about fermions, you have your system, put it into a box, and you have a reference system. If you have fermions with going up to Fermi momentum, you can now worry. Should I keep the number of fermions fixed if I do the subtraction, or should I keep the chemical potential or the Fermi energy fixed? If you keep the number of fermions fixed, you are doing a canonical calculation. That is done here, reported here. And if you keep the chemical potential fixed, you do a grand canonical calculation. If you take the reference volume to infinity, it doesn't matter. So therefore, I'm using basically. And that explains also the occurrence in the Casimir energy of this extra mu in the energy folding. So, and that makes sure that, I mean, if I come close to the Fermi momentum, this weight vanishes again. Okay. Good. So let me now, since you asked once more, make the philosophy clear. So we start with a large container. This we fill up with something. I mean, for instance, fluctuating photon gas or Fermi matter. And we have to adjust our full density of states to the background density of states. I mean, we can calculate it. We have a large but finite container. We can calculate that quantity. Now, we or a cosmic cookie puncher comes and makes holes into this arrangement. And because there are holes in this Fermi background, you have to pay a price. You have excluded volume. You have surface terms. You might have Friedel oscillations. All that you have to take into account, and that are subsumed in this Weyl contributions. A contribution that depends basically on the radius, on the surface, on the boundary condition that you put on the surface, etc. And since they are far separated, these holes, we have introduced them far separated, you have additive terms for each one additive. Now your cosmic cookie puncher or you come and move the holes, in closer contact, and the level density again, the density of states will has to be readjusted. So you have to introduce a new term that takes care of that, because some of these modes, as you can see here, are shielded. I mean, one obstacle shields or the modes hitting the other obstacle. So this is basically the density or geometry dependent part of the density of states, and this is the quantity we are after. Now here comes your Krein trace formula. So you subtract this piece here, the background part, from a full density of state, and you average a little bit, and then you can remove the container walls and treat the whole problem as a scattering problem. Right, I mean, you scatter from the outside at the system. You have single scattering or multiple scattering. So this is a Krein trace formula. But we are not yet there. I mean, we are not interested at this difference. We want also subtract the Weyl terms from this expression to get the geometry-dependent part. So fortunately, you can separate you can write the determinant of non-overlapping n-sphere S matrix as product of the determinants of a single sphere S matrices and the ratio of a multi-scattering matrix evaluated at K and K conjugate. So with this expression, you can prove everything works out nicely because all the T matrices involved are trace class in this situation. So now you have a modified Krein formula that takes into account just this part, of course averaged a little bit, and links it to the multi-scattering part of the S matrix. And all these calculations, all determinants exists, everything, I mean, this determinant, that determinant, that determinant, that, all exist because the relevant associated T matrices are all trace class. Trace class means that the modulus of a trace exists in any orthonormal basis. Okay, now you have this quantity here, namely given by this. When you fold it with the energy minus the chemical potential, integrate up to the chemical potential, and there you are. That's the cosmic energy for this problem. So, now...
You answered my question with the next slide.
Well, now you only have to have a closed form expression for the multi-scattering matrix, and for the n-sphere problem, you have a tier for the n-disk problem, it's simpler. So the multiscattering matrix is basically given by 1. You have no multiscattering. And then the deviation from 1. That is given by basically terms that come from a single T matrix of a scattering object involving Bessel functions and Hankel functions. Then you have a transfer matrix that goes from one object to the next one involving a Hankel function and a spherical harmonic. You have to orientate the system, so you have Wigner rotation matrices. And you have to angular momentum couple, you have 3 J symbols or Clebsch-Gordons. And so this is the expression for this problem. So this is a complicated expression, so let's first discuss it in the limit that the scatterers are small. And maybe that helps you also. So when the multi-scattering matrix is 1, no scattering, and when you have 2 obstacles, let's say, 2 small obstacles, and you have then from one obstacle going spherical waves going out to the next obstacle and making here an S-wave scattering. That's basically all that what there is in this formula. So we have spherical waves going from one object to the next object, and then folding in the S-wave scattering amplitude, and the next correction would be P-wave scattering. So let's apply it to 2 spheres of radius A. In my, I use the convention that all the time the radius is called A, the distance, center-to-center distance R. So some people use it in the opposite sense, just to confuse people. But this is from different communities, I mean. So this is the semi-classical notation. Good. So here you have the situation. 2 spheres or disks of radius A at center-to-center dispersion R. So if you now use this expression, I mean this form, you have then the multi-scattering matrix that you plug into this expression to get the integrated number density of states. You have a degeneracy factor for spin and isospin, 2 or 4. Then you have basically, because of this radial wave movement and taking the matrix part, a sine, 2r, usual factor 2 because you go back and forth. And for each scattering center, you get minus a because you don't hit there. I mean, this is coming from the S wave amplitude. You get 1 over r squared because you have this spherical wave twice. And you get an a squared here from the S wave. So this is a simple formula. Now, if you would sum up not just the S wave, but all partial waves, you get to a semi-classical expression. And the semi-classical expression looks very similar. It's basically the first term in the Gutzwiller-Trace formula for people who are familiar with semi-classics. So it looks very similar to the S-wave scattering. Basically, the difference is here really the periodic orbit is appearing. When you this length r minus 2a is just this length here, and you have twice because you go back and forth, as in the plate case. You have a sine again. You have a square there. You have pi. That's this one comes from here. You have r and a small modification with stability. However, you have a relative suppression of a factor 1 over 4th. And that's important that we see several times. So the difference between S-wave scattering and the full semi-classical scattering is a factor 1/2 per obstacle. So you get here a factor 1/2 and here a factor 1/2, altogether a factor 1 over 4th. So therefore, the S-wave scattering will be enhanced in comparison to the semi-classical scattering. The semi-classical scattering is linked to the proximity force approximation. Good. So 2 spheres. It was shown by Schaden and Spruch that the semi-classical approximation is the proximity force approximation. So now we look at the numerics. We have 2 spheres. R, A, the radii. So here we look how good this formula works. In the exact calculation where we use the exact expression, this expression here, and in the semi-classical expression where we use this simpler formula here. So this is the exact calculation, and here's the semi-classical calculation as function of a separation or as function of a wave number for fixed separation. And you see the deviations between the semi-classical result and the exact result are only for very small separations, as you would expect, or for a very small wave number. Well, okay, why? This is probably slightly counterintuitive to the standard Casimir effect. I mentioned the physics is dominated at the UV scale in this situation, and so it will be so you will. I mean, it will work best. Okay, semi-classics will work better for large argument, for large. No, these are Friedel oscillations would be for one obstacle. This is superposition of Friedel oscillations, or right? The Friedel oscillations are.
Would compute them for two objects, you would get basically the same thing.
Yeah, but I mean, first you have to compute it for.
In fact, I think Cohen and others a long time.
I will come to this, but. Yeah, but I will do it for point particles, yes. Yeah. I will come to this. Okay, so if you. The Casimir energy is now the integrated structure over the numbers, number density. And the number of states, not the number density, integral over number of states up to a Fermi momentum. And, well, this is basically Bessel function, as you can see. And so you end up with a Bessel function. And it scales as a square, the radius of the obstacle, over 1 over the length to a third power. So it's definitely long range. And it's oscillating, as you can see, with the Bessel function. And the oscillating part of this, why it's oscillating, we have a second scale in the problem, in the Fermi momentum. And that allows for you to have an oscillating function. I mean, what will happen if you remove the Fermi momentum? That we might encounter a scalar Casimir effect.
This is at zero temperature.
This is zero temperature,
so
yeah.
This will be very strongly dependent on sharp boundaries, I presume.
Well, if you weaken the bound, we will come to, you mentioned Lau and Kohn, we will come to this. I mean, sphere plate geometry, you have even a larger, longer distance. It scales as 1 A over L squared. So, good. So let's now look at make the system more complicated. Let's look at 3 and 4 spheres. I all the time assume symmetrical systems, so equilateral triangle of 3 spheres or 4 spheres and then a symmetric tetrahedron to make a calculation simple. We will see that, yes, there are many-body contributions, but for these systems, basically, the two bounds orbits still dominate the calculation. Maximum corrections for free bounds orbits will be 10% at separation r equals 2.5 in the radius. Center-to-center separation 2.5 of the radius. So what is plotted here? I start out calculating the weight of these periodic orbits, multiplied by a factor of 3, and this is the 1. And now I calculate the weight of this periodic orbit, the triangle, with a degeneracy. And this is plotted here relative to this weight of these periodic orbits. So as you can see, it's at most 10% at 2.5a. I can now look at more complicated periodic orbits, namely the repeat of this orbit. That is another periodic orbit that is suppressed, as you can see. Or I can look at this four periodic orbit. With its degeneracy factor, it's also suppressed. I can go on to a five periodic orbit, where 5 scatterings till it repeats itself. And it has a degeneracy factor of 6 even, because I can go in both directions and can choose one of the disks. Even that is suppressed, even with its degeneracy, and so on. All these periodic orbits are suppressed, and in comparison to this leading periodic orbit. So, and of course, you know what happens. I mean, from playing billiard. I mean, if you ever played pool billiard or more complicated things, I mean, you never would try. I mean, to shoot with one ball 4 for other balls. I mean, this would be completely...
This is an explanation of how it falls off with distance.
Yeah, yeah. Distance and reflection. Because you have all the time, of course, at each reflection you lose. It's everything is hyperbolic. So with distance and, more importantly, with the number of reflections. So now let's look to the calculation. We have now here, for instance, Casimir energy for an equilateral triangle with three balls as function of a wave number for two separations. As function of a Fermi number, E divided by the chemical potential. And you see it's attractive, repulsive, attractive, repulsive, then goes eventually to zero. Same here. So now I compare it. This is for the equilateral triangle. And now I compare it just to the subsystem. And since the subsystem appears three times multiplied by a factor of three, and you see, basically, I mean, this two bounds orbit dominates the whole calculation, except at small wave number or small separations. It will be more pronounced at small separations, as you can see. You can do the same for four spheres on a tetrahedron. So here's the Casimir energy again plotted. Here we did run out of steam, but basically you can imagine how it will go on. And now I compare it to four times the two bounds orbit. One, two, four, to six times the two bounds orbit. And you see it also matches. Of course, you get deviations at small wave number. But basically, it matches again, and the curve is more or less a Bessel function again. Or I match it to twice the free bounds orbit. Why twice? I mean, normally if tetrahedron has four faces, but every two faces share one edge. So therefore the factor two.
Another simplistic question. So if I'm using the proximity force idea, that's like a geometric optics analog here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what would it look like on this scale? It would be factor off? It would smooth out these guys? Or we're just looking at as if it's all coming from outside with large objects.
Oh, for proximity. Semi classics works pretty well, so I think the proximity force approximation is, of course, not semi classics. If you use semi classics, yeah, it works well. Semi classics approximates the proximity force approximation for very small separations.
Precisely, yeah.
So for a very small separation, it works, but probably not
I'm
for.
I'm not saying it works here, I'm saying if you really. I'm trying to see what's bouncing around, which is your periodicity clearly, because it's what fits and doesn't fit between.
This is
you go to the other extreme of just pressure from outside, but it goes over to that, I guess, right? When you go to R equals 2+1.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, I mean, when our semi-classics breaks, of course, down, as you can see. So who knows? I mean, if you go to smaller wave number or smaller separation, it gets more complicated. Good. We were, more or less interested in this neutron star situation, and that was fine for us to continue with this estimate. So that we were happy that we could use it. The domination of the two bounds orbits. Good.
One question. You showed term by term that the higher order things get smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
If you imagine having a dense network of.
Yeah, of course. You might. No.
The combinatorial family.
It might in the end, it combinatorics might win against. That's of course the point. Exactly, of course, yes. I mean, if I have a multi-scattering matrix, I can solve it exactly. But when the semi-classics, I happen to get enough periodic orbits to do the semi-classics. I could also solve the semi-classics. But it gets more complicated. For the exact calculation, it's not very much difference. I mean, it doesn't mind whether the underlying problem is chaotic or not. But for the semi-classics, you have to work harder. Good. So I have explained all this. Yeah, the corrections, as you have seen here, are in the order of 10% for the free Bohr system and 25% for the four Bohr system. Good. So let me now, since it was mentioned, look at add atoms on metal surfaces. That is probably one way where you have seen these free type of oscillations, or where you expect these free type of oscillations. Actually, experimentally, they were found only not too long ago. So Repp et al. Have done STM snapshots in a certain area of kappa ad atoms on a closed packed kappa 111 surface. I mean, the pictures were taken at 9 Kelvin, and they made then basically a movie out of this. I mean, so it's not one picture, they took lots of pictures. Here you have basically a step. So I think this is a step up and this is a step down. So just that you know what we have. And you see in hexagonal islands of order in these of these kappa ad atoms on this surface. And the average ad atom distance is in the order of 10, 12 angstroms. So it's not the atomic distance, but it's a super distance. So, and what we did is, of course, I looked at these pictures, not one picture, but the complete movie, and looked at the meta distribution two particle distribution, basically. We plotted as function of a distance for all these movies. And since we have a finite region of this levels off eventually, but you see modulations in that structure. And they map this modulation to an effective two-pair potential. It is plotted down here. And you see this two-pair potential has this oscillating behavior. Here once more, slightly in a smaller window. So what you see, you can then fit this oscillating behavior to the following expression. The function goes as sine 2kfr. Remember, kfr is here now, which turn out to be the separation between the center of the atoms. And plus 2 delta and sine squared delta, this comes from the S-wave scattering. When we have this suppression 1 over r squared, this is two-dimensional, not three-dimensional, two-dimensional, goes as 1 over r squared. Factors of pi squared that come as usual. Then this factor 4, because we have S-wave scattering, 2 times 2 is a factor 4. And then a factor that takes care that these are not hard obstacles, but, I mean, atoms and the surface electrons may go into the atoms, something we don't see at hard spheres. So you have a reduction factor, and here you see the numbers that we use in the fit. And that works quite well. So, yes, this is known. This is, just for S-wave scattering, people have done this calculation.
But this is absorbed on a three-dimensional system, so it's
a layer, yeah. You have spheres on the surface, electrons bounce back and forth between them. And you have an attraction where the surface, where the wavelength of the surface electrons is just that it gives the attraction.
You're seeing a two-dimensional...
Yeah, and you can treat it as a two-dimensional quasi-system, and you have this fudge factor A.
It's a slightly surprising thing you'd have guessed that
No, these are surface electrons. I mean, only where the electrons are on the surface are important.
Yeah. this is result is obtained by applying some kind of boundary condition really to the atoms?
No, this is S-wave scattering. So you have no bar. You have just the T matrix for S-wave potential scattering, yeah. Mm? And then you have a fudge factor A, I mean, that but you adjust.
You have only things on one dimension?
Well, where's it B? What, can you repeat?
Brain B, southwest corner.
No, this is here, I think, a step down. And some of them accumulate at this step. So, of course, I think in the real calculation, we use a system where you don't have steps. This is just shown in the paper. We have just shown these two STM pictures. But here you see the hexagonal order. You also see the hexagonal suborder, right, of basically surface electrons.
But is there a different geometry there that maybe can work out? There's a one-dimensional step that they can
I have. We have not. As far as I know, we have not worked it out. But who knows? We were just intrigued. You see it also here. They accumulate at the step. But don't like to jump down the step. Apparently, this is step down. And this is step up. If they accumulate here, it's probably clear. But they accumulate also at a step down. So they're afraid to jump down.
Worry about the underlying attraction of the. Of a layer underneath because it's on a much smaller length.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you have a lattice underneath, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
So isn't
but really, this is a smaller length scale, yeah.
Is it really a different problem to look at electrons, surface electrons on a bulk metal influencing these ad atoms? Is that a somewhat different physical problem?
No, I think it's you see the structure as the formula is the same. Only that you have your potential scattering, we have no hard scattering, right? I mean, and these people were content with basically S-wave scattering amplitude. Well, basically we have soft scattering, maybe we say higher amplitudes are not important. So this is. Let me come now to another system. We have again excluded volumes. But inside the excluded volumes, we now to put a superfluid. Because you might have pairing. I mean, the nuclei, you might have pairing in the interaction in the nuclei. So we wanted to look what this will do. And if you have now, a periodic orbit or a trajectory hitting a superfluid obstacle with sharp bounding conditions, you don't have specular reflections. But you have Andreev reflection. You see the particle scattered at the same side of the normal, to the normal. It's basically focused by the. If you are at the Fermi momentum, the particle is retro reflected as whole. So you can go from here to here to here and here, and it would not matter. But of course, you are not completely at the Fermi momentum. So if you are away from the Fermi momentum, you get a modified Snell's law, this law here. And you all the time are scattered to the same side of a normal. In specular reflections, you would be scattered to the other side of a normal. Specular reflection would give you a hyperbolic behavior of the wave bundles. Here, focus of behavior of the wave bundles. Okay, and here we have the result. We look now at two disks, two-dimensional problem. Separation is six times of a radius. We were shooting particles away at angle phi with direction theta. So if the angle phi is plotted, theta minus phi is plotted. This is basically the deviation from the direction of the axis. And you see now you get basically this Poincaré surface of sections, and you see stable regions, unstable regions. For a specular case, you would have just one unstable periodic orbit here. But for this Andreev reflection, you get this whole mass. So your first naive expectation is you will get enhancement. Strong enhancement because you have much more periodic orbits in the system than in the other systems. So, well, you replace now your Helmholtz equation by a Bogoyubov Degen equation, where you have in the off diagonal this pair field that is only different from zero inside these obstacles. We assume the same value, but allow for a different phase of zero otherwise. So we solve a system and plug it then into a modified Krein form and a particle hole space. So when we have calculate this by doing this, we can calculate the integrated number density of states. This is when given you encounter probably structures that you know. I mean, here's for instance a particle term, effector 2, particle wave number times r, r is the separation again between these two obstacles that you know of. It's here cosine because we have taken the phase explicit here. So you have it for the whole the same. Only where you have a sign change, you have here then the structure functions. It's two-dimensional, therefore we have only 1 over r here, 1 over r here. However, for the particle hole part, you have not affected 2, but the particle momentum and the hole momentum with a minus sign. Right? I mean, it's so we don't add up or subtract from each other. And the weight factor is 4. Okay. So these structure functions are nothing else but the sum over the angular momentum pieces of a T matrices. So you have a T matrices, you sum up the angular momentum parts. And here we are, the real and the metric part of these structure functions are plotted. And you see here the particle-particle part, the whole-whole part. We used a gap in of the order of 50 in units of a radius squared, and the chemical potential in the order of 200 in units of a radius squared. So here, this is plotted as function of quasi-particle energy. So here, we would expect that the gap vanishes. So you see the particle structure function is oscillating. The whole structure function gets only contributions in close to the gap and above it. Particle hole is very dominant below the gap and then branches out, goes to zero. And you see the difference that it's dominant, the difference in scale. Here the scale is 2, here the scale is 2,000. And here you have now the density of states as function of quasi-particle energy. And something funny happens. All this density of states that you observe for all the systems start out positive and go negative, positive, negative. And since you weight them in the Casimir effect, weight the infrared behavior in the standard Casimir effect, you would expect in the standard Casimir calculation then attraction. Here you start out negative. So this will be a repulsive system. And it dies off. I mean, so basically it's not dominated at the UV point. It's dominated at infrared. And you have the standard quantization. You can get the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization condition, Kp minus Kh times the reflection coefficient, the standard reflection. If E goes to zero, then this will be just pi halves times 2 will be minus pi. That explains then the sign of a repulsion. So this quantization condition corresponds basically to the zeros here of these oscillations. I mean, the full curve is the exact calculation, dashed curve is the semi-classical approximation. So if you let E, the quasi-particle energy, very small in comparison to the gap, then the formula, the level density, or the number density, the number of states is very simple. Well, it's given by this factor, this oscillating factor we have understood. This is R minus 2A. This is this length for particle propagation minus the whole propagation. That's this factor here. When you have a standard stability in two dimension, 1 over r, the wave number, when you have a difference in the phase of these two superfluids, that gives the cosine. So this vector in front, well, the minus sign first. The minus sign is just here coming from this expression. If e goes to 0, you get pi halves. Times 2, it's a factor minus pi here. That makes this minus sign. So, and now a weight factor. If you make the first fluctuations around the periodic orbit, you get this weight factor. And if you go to e equals 0, it gives just a weight 2kFa squared. What is 2kFa? This is just the range in the impact parameter. It's nothing else than 4m max. 2kF is 2m max. You are two-dimensional. You go if angular momentum is bigger than that, you would not hit the other disk. So this is basically understood, and so you can understand the whole expression. Ooh, I did something funny. How do I get rid of? Okay. Good. Can you? Oh yeah. Good. Yeah, and when you can use this result to integrate up and getting the expression for the full superfluid Casimir, the Casimir energy for the superfluid situation, you have a degeneracy factor, spin, isospin, integration over E times this level density now. And you can integrate it up again in this expression. You plug in numbers, and you get an expression. And you compare it to the modulus of a standard calculation for two spheres. And this factor x is in the order of unity. So as long as kf is not too large, this part dominates in comparison to that part. Good, because the Bessel function becomes small. And gets smaller and smaller. So this part is the dominating part. So you get from this superfluid, you get a repulsive Casimir effect that dominates at small wave numbers and good. So conclusions for this system. We have shown you that effective interactions between voids inside a non-interacting fermion background exist. So you get a force onto nothing from something. This new form of Casimir energy is neither attractive nor repulsive, but changes sign according to the relative arrangement of the scatterers. If I increase the distance between the scatterers, I can make it repulsive, attractive, repulsive. The Casimir contributions are well approximate semi-classically because the system is dominated at the UV point, not at the infrared point. There exist many body Casimir contribution N-sphere systems. They are, however, short-ranged and dominated by the long-range two-body interactions. Of course, I've only presented results for symmetric arrangements of spheres, but for asymmetric configurations, we have made some test calculations and found similar behavior. If you, of course, go into very extreme, that you have one, for instance, a three-sphere system, who knows, I mean, make extreme cases, then probably things might change. So the spheres can be replaced with other objects if the curvature radii are larger than the Fermi wavelength. The important thing is they should not overlap, because as long as they're not overlap, you have one system here, one other system there, and so you could put everything into the y terms that you subtract out. As mentioned, buckyballs in Fermi liquids, liquid mercury or liquid free helium may be a possibility. And in the astrophysical applications, nuclei immersed in a neutron gas and a neutron star crust. And it's of the same order as the energy differences between the various Italian phases. Its long range and oscillating and therefore disordered lattices are rather expected than the Italian phases. If you have pairing interaction, then Andreev reflection comes into the play. You have focusing and defocusing scattering. Particle hole dominates and the effect is repulsive. And this map method is also applicable to scattering systems and for traditional Casimir problems. So let me, in the last 5 minutes, just repeat for you. You remember this this argument. Now imagine that this is fluctuating photon gas. What's the difference? Well, you integrate up to infinity here at this point. And then you can rewrite this in this form. Now, you can even try to evaluate it on real axis. I mean, with a cutoff, I mean, it takes it's tedious and takes long time, but you can do it. But of course, it's much more useful to make the Wick rotation. And here's your final formula if you have done the Wick rotation. For relativistic dispersion, you can do that. And you are allowed to do that because of the unitarity of the S matrices imply this condition for you. However, if you have a different weight, not a relativistic weight, but a non-relativistic weight, or any weight that goes with an odd number of a wave number, this formula here implies that basically the Casimir energy would integrate to zero. So for a non-relativistic, if you would make a stupid thing to integrate a non-relativistic fluctuating field to infinity, that doesn't make sense, but I mean, you can be so stupid to do it, you would get zero. So why don't we find zero for the Fermionic Casimir effect? Because we have a cutoff here. And that prevents us from finding zero as answer. So as long as you have a cutoff, things are fine. But as soon as you have these funny structures, you will find zero.
I have an allergic response to the Wick curve. So how much of it is by decision and how much of it is from?
No, Fermi momentum at temperature zero is a cutoff. This is just
nature makes this cutoff.
Not nature, yeah, yeah.
As long as you assume you're cold enough.
It's either it's zero or it's full. It's one. Good. So I mean, therefore you can find a finite answer. And let's one last word about this. Well, okay. Let's start with a scalar Casimir. This is the last transparency when I finish. So we looked some time ago. Well, the first people who were looking at the scalar Casimir effect were Dirichlet spheres or plates, and looking at the how good the proximity force approximation was Schad and Spruch. If I found that the proximity force approximation is confirmed by semi-classics periodic orbits. So basically, then Gies and Langfield have taken up this problem and looked in the word line approach to this problem. Here you see the word lines for a plate and a sphere. And as discussed some time ago, only word lines that hit both obstacles contribute to the Casimir energy. It's the same idea as behind multi-scattering contribution to the level density, to the geometry dependent part of the level density. Very same idea. So with this part, that part drops out. And here you have now the results of the calculation of Gies at Langfield. The exact calculation in units of proximity force approximation at small separation. And you see it deviates, becomes larger here. This calculation is basically a proximity force approximation. And that is some calculations by Scardiccio and Jaffe for an optical approach that follows this curve for some while and then deviates. Now, remember I told you this factor that the S-wave scattering is larger than the semi-classic scattering by factor 2 per reflection. So you have a sphere plate system. You have this factor 2. And when you have in the semi-classic scattering, you would have the proximity force approximation of semi-classic scattering with all the repeats. At short separation, you have to repeat your periodic orbit. And the repeats of a periodic orbit induce a factor 1 over, or term 1 over n to the fourth power, n from 1 to infinity. This is pi to the fourth 90. So you have to remove these repeats That's therefore you have a factor 90 over pi to the fourth and then this factor 2. And then you end up with a periodic proximity force approximation for small separations times 90 over pi to the fourth times 2. This is a factor 1.847. And this is given here. So this is a factor 1.847. And this are the exact results that we calculated. And this is this formula, the blue formula. Again, in these units, as function of this separation L over A. And now, this is Klaus Klingmüller and Holger Gies have improved their calculation. Here you hardly can see it. This is this, our result. Here is this curve in Cyan, and it agrees very well with our numerical calculation. The horizontal axis is L over A. This axis here, this is A is the radius of the spheres, L is the separation, surface-to-surface separation.
These deviations of the two curves are indicating a failure of the PFA, is that what we're saying?
Yeah. And here you actually see you have two predictions of a PFA, the PFA plate-based and the PFA surface-based, because for such a problem you can either do it like this, or you can do it like this, right? For large separations, this deviates. I mean, you can either align the tiny plate condensators with one surface or the other surface. And it makes a difference in what you see in this curve here, plotted by these two curves, I think. The plate-based is the upper one, the sphere-based is the other, and it goes in a complete wrong direction. Even the sign is wrong. And these are the numerical data points of Holger Gies and Klaus Klingmüller. And the curve in Cyan is our numerical curve that is exact. And this is here the limit 1.847. Okay, so I think I will stop here at this point. I've shown.
If I go home with the number 1% in my head, it's up to there, it's okay.
Well, the proximity force approximation works at small separations, but
small, yeah. This is a special situation, right? This is still in boundary conditions. You have the same. Yet the power law is correct. I mean, it's the same in short and large separations. Therefore, you get just basically a modification of the amplitude. If you do this for, say, Neumann electromagnetic scattering, you get a completely different power law. So your curve would change, I mean, would not just be changing the amplitude, you would go over orders of magnitude. Right? Mm-hmm. So that's a very special case.
But for very large separations, of course.
It's very weak.
Mm-hmm.
So this is enough to miss. So that doesn't apply to photons.
Right.
For photons, it's much stronger, the deviation.
No, I mean, it seemed pretty generous to me when you said 1%.
Yeah, yeah, this
I was thinking like, 0.01%.
Yeah, but in experiments, of course, we are in this regime, right? I mean, basically, the radius is in the orders of 100 micrometers, and the separation, your separation is even 10 nanometers. The other guys have separations, except Lamoureux, but Lamoureux has, again, larger spheres, right? So where all of them are in, I think, in this regime even. Good. Thank you very much for your attention.